This is Fortune's Wheel, a podcast history of the late Middle Ages, and I'm Jonathan. On the last episode, we ended with Pope Gregory VII, formerly known as Archdeacon Hildebrand, a man who had been behind every major papal reform over the last 20 years. Well, we ended with this man facing three dilemmas simultaneously. First, Saxony was reestablishing its claim on the German crown. Second, he received a panicked letter from the Byzantine emperor requesting immediate assistance against the encroaching Seljuk Turks, who were quickly moving across Anatolia. And third, Robert Guiscard was once again not playing nice in southern Italy. It was shaping up to be one hell of a first year for the Pope. On this episode, we will see how all of this plays out. We'll stay between August of 1073 and early spring of 1075, which admittedly is beyond his first year by several months, but it seems he never really got his feet steady until then. This is episode 123, entitled The Holy Satan's First Year, Part 2. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. The Holy Satan had made it to the papacy. Peter Damian's words still sting today, and it's worth remembering despite how accurate it was or wasn't, because that's what some people thought of the old archdeacon prior to him becoming pope. Powerful, influential, street smarts out of the you-know-what. Pope Gregory VII was not universally loved, that's without question, but at the end of the day, he had finally reached the pinnacle of his field. Pope Gregory VII. The name would go down as one of the most important popes in all of Catholic history. His reforms, a continuation of his work under Alexander II, Nicholas II, and Leo IX, would have far-reaching consequences beyond anything we've seen so far. But it did not come without its fair share of slings and arrows along the way. And those slings and arrows began immediately. Remember, he was deeply involved with a married noblewoman in Tuscany named Matilda. He was tangentially negotiating a tumultuous rebellion in Germany as Saxony reinserted itself as a claimant to the German crown, as it was in the days of all those King Ottos. And he was in possession of an earth-shaking letter from a Byzantine emperor pleading for help against the Seljuks. And then finally there was Robert Guiscard. There was always Robert Guiscard. And Robert Guiscard, throughout early to mid-1074, had been busy. The Benevento debacle, learning about Gregory VII visiting Richard of Capua right after the Benevento debacle. See, for this, we need to understand this latest uprising in Apulia by Robert's nephew Abelard, son of Humphrey de Hopeville, who was cheated out of his inheritance by Robert himself. This was the little rebellion by Abelard that began when Robert was besieging and ultimately subduing the mighty city of Palermo back in 1072 to 1073. Abelard had been put down once, but he'd been at it again. Robert had returned to a simple rebellion that was really only simple on its surface. Underneath, Robert realized that even though he'd put down the second of Abelard's rebellions, ending with the humiliation of Peter of Trani months earlier, Abelard had unleashed a little Joffrey in the form of his brother-in-law. Yes, Sicilgaita's own little brother, Gisulf II of Salerno, had joined Abelard, and when Abelard surrendered the cause, Gisulf II determined he was having too much fun torturing Robert's men, and decided to keep it all going just a bit longer. Well, Robert obviously had to walk a fine line as it was his wife's brother, but he was also not just gonna sit idly by while this little sneeze wreaked havoc on his men. Martial decency, even in the 11th century, still held some sort of decorum between fighting men on both sides of a conflict, especially sides with a direct familial relationship between their leaders. But Gisulf II threw this all out of the window. Malaterra writes, quote, "At first, Duke Guiscard, who had promised friendship to him, bore this patiently. He sent envoys to arrange a meeting to persuade Gisulf to adopt a more prudent course than the one he had adopted. But when he realized the evil that was lodged in the prince's heart, and that the more he tried to be conciliatory, the worse the prince's behavior became. Then he renounced the treaty between them and prepared for inexorable hostilities towards the man who had proved to be hostile to him." End quote. Well, the thing is, as much as the Duke wanted to gut the little prick, his wife's brother or not, some more of that post-Barry level-headed wisdom was kicking in. He knew that his relationship with Prince Richard of Capua on the other side of Salerno was pretty strained already, especially now that the Pope had entered into a treaty, you know, specifically aiming to take Guiscard down. So he held off on immediate action and slyly snuck an envoy over to discuss peace terms with the Duke of Aversa and Capua. This had the tertiary effect of undermining any deal Richard had made with Gregory against him. This agreement might hem in Gisulf II on two sides. And remember, Richard was Norman. Robert was also Norman. And Robert married Sicilgaita, a Lombard, making Gisulf II of Salerno a Lombard prince. At least Robert and Richard were both Normans. It was a small but brilliant move that would ensure that Gisulf wouldn't be able to run north to Richard and ask for help once Robert attacked. It seemed the hammer had learned a little nuance in his pounding of annoying little nails. When his treaty was finalized, Malaterra tells us, quote, "Guiscard then set off with a large army to besiege Salerno," end quote. Another principality on the other side of Salerno from Robert's domains was Amalfi. If you remember, they were the ones we just learned assassinated Gisulf's dad, the much-respected Guiamar IV. So it's no shocker to say that Salerno and Amalfi were not on anything resembling friendly terms. In fact, it's not much of a surprise when Malaterra just comes out and says it. Quote unquote, "The Amalfitans loathed Gisulf." So when Robert Guiscard approached them with a deal that would allow him to utilize the Amalfitan navy against Salerno, they knew it was a good way to get rid of their hated enemy. However, negotiations weren't easy, and Robert Guiscard was forced to give a brutal ultimatum. Really, you know, just reminding them that they didn't really have much of a leg to stand on in the first place. I mean, Robert was just being nice at the beginning. He was nice with negotiating, but he knew the Amalfitans would help him whether they liked it or not. To be fair, though, Robert gave them what they asked for in the end, but in exchange, Robert was able to move freely through the city of Amalfi itself and use it as a forward base of operations on the other side from his duchy. Malaterra tells us he immediately built four castles around the city and stocked them with his own men. Yeah, Amalfi was essentially Duke Robert's at this point. Guiscard just never runs out of ways to shock you, does he? So jump a few months to 1074. Robert Guiscard controlled Apulia, Calabria, and northern Sicily, and now also Amalfi. And really, for all intents and purposes, he was slowly but surely barreling down on the county of Salerno. With the exception of the proud Duke Richard of Capua, who controlled both Aversa and Capua, Robert Guiscard was the face of southern Italy. Period. And that flew in the face of all the work that Pope Gregory VII had strived for over 20 years. This simply could not stand. In early 1074, Gregory sent letters up north asking for support. Curiously, none of these letters made it to Germany because, well, screw them, right? But they made it to, of course, Beatrice and Matilda in Tuscany, as well as Azzo, the Marquis of Est, Count William of Burgundy, Count Amadeus of Savoy, and Count Raymond IV of Toulouse, keep that name in mind, who would one day become a major player in the First Crusade. Why was he sending all these letters out? Well, Gregory was raising an army. against Robert Guiscard so that he could be rid of the Norman forever, consolidate southern Italy to be at the very least loyal to the papacy completely, and then hurry over to Constantinople to embark on that crusade that Michael VII Doukas was desperately asking for. John Julius Norwich, in his book The Other Conquest, quotes this correspondence giving Gregory's purpose for these drastic measures against his Norman vassals. Norwich writes, quote, "Furthermore, we trust that yet further good may emerge in that, once the Normans are subdued, we may continue to Constantinople to the aid of those Christians who, beset by most frequent Saracen attacks, do insistently implore our aid," end quote. So in the end, he was trying to simply eliminate the one obstacle to him feeling comfortable enough to launch a crusade out east. That one obstacle? Robert Guiscard. But see, here's the thing. Robert Guiscard had also been corresponding with Emperor Michael VII. And that same year, in 1074, Robert and Michael VII had entered in an agreement. An agreement that could really mess things up across the Mediterranean. In exchange for Norman support, Michael VII, who was just bouncing a little baby boy on his knee at the time, had betrothed his newborn son to Guiscard's pre-adolescent daughter. Yeah, Robert Guiscard was about to marry into the Byzantine royal family. His grandchildren would be emperors. Emperors of the rival Roman Empire in the West. You can imagine how this news was received by Gregory VII. It seems the Holy Satan's first year was a prescient one, one that would define the old power broker's entire papacy. So what does his second year have in store? What could possibly top the first year? Well, as you can see, there are plenty of moving parts in Gregory's first year, plenty of ways for him to, you know, mess up or come up empty or just even succeed in the first place. There was nothing secure about his position, except that he held the papacy. His reforms were all put on hold, and his imperial dreams were directly threatened by this marriage alliance between Guiscard and Michael VII. So, he doubled down and went full steam ahead on creating the army that would take down the mighty Norman. But first, let's hold our annual late winter, early spring synod, because that's just what we do in the springtime. The Lenten Synod of 1074 was held in Rome. Gregory VII reaffirmed his commitment to the reforms implemented over the last year, as well as those issued over the previous 20 years. Issues such as the selling of church offices, remember called simony, clerical celibacy, and the practice of holding more than one bishopric, also called plurality. These were all publicly condemned once again by the Pope. But he did something else which would further stoke the flames between the papacy and the King of Germany. Gregory VII excommunicated more German bishops and priests in an effort to prop them up as examples of what happens when you act against the Pope's decrees. Well, there might have been a bit of pettiness involved as well, because if you remember, the autumn before in 1073, the German bishops did everything but excommunicate Gregory VII. The only thing stopping them was the fact that they, you know, didn't have the authority to excommunicate anybody. Otherwise, they probably would have. So that was Gregory VII's little payback. But let's get at the heart of this excommunication. What was their supposed crime, these German bishops? One of Gregory's biggest complaints across Christendom was the practice of investiture, which is the appointing of certain people, priests or not, in certain church positions with power. A king could appoint anyone he wished to, say, a bishopric, without the Pope's approval. This was a problem, as tradition always held that bishoprics and archbishoprics were given papal sanctioning whenever someone new took over. For instance, these new bishops and archbishops even had a practice of traveling all the way to Rome to receive the Pope's personal blessing. The practice of investiture had gotten completely out of hand by the mid-11th century, and Gregory, in an attempt to reinforce some of those radical Cluniac reforms he was so fond of, well, he sought to stamp it out completely. Who better to use as the whipping boy than the one kingdom he thought was the worst on its overreach of the papacy, the one kingdom who laid claim to the imperial crown, should it be given to him by the Pope, of the Holy Roman Empire. So Gregory VII ignored all those other acts of investiture around Europe, such as William the Conqueror's investiture of Lanfranc as Archbishop of Canterbury, among others. We ignored them all, and he focused on Germany, the one kingdom he could do without, as far as he was concerned. So, for the crime of investiture, Gregory VII excommunicated every German priest or bishop who had received the German king's appointment. It was a bold move to focus solely on one kingdom. But what did Gregory care? The problem of the German crown encroaching on papal politics had to be dealt with once and for all. And here's the real kicker regarding the 1074 Lenten Synod in Rome. Do you remember from the last episode that in the autumn of 1073, just, you know, months earlier, King Henry IV wrote Pope Gregory VII asking for forgiveness, giving his full support to the papacy, and taking responsibility for everything that had occurred in Milan 2 years earlier? Do you remember that? Well, now, reading between the lines, this was in exchange for papal support against those pesky Saxon rebels. But Gregory, whether he saw it as such or not, decided to twist it all up a bit. And this right here is what gave all of these reforms about simony and celibacy, plurality and investiture, all the weight they needed. Michelle Cake Spike, in her book Tuscan Countess, tells it like this. During the formal ceremonies and processions of the synod, steeped deeply in history and tradition, we see the tiara that the Pope wore was slightly different in this one. Something was added to it to signify a change in the general approach and aspect of the papacy. Pope Gregory VII, on the heels of receiving Henry IV's submission, you could call it, well, he had ordered a gold rim to be added to the tiara. Why a gold rim? Well, coupled with the message given by him at the synod, the tiara was less religious ornament and more, now, a crown, as the Holy Roman Imperial crown was also rimmed with gold. The message that Gregory VII sent to Christendom, he would rewrite the goals of the papacy, and they would henceforth be more in line with imperial goals rather than spiritual ones. Pope Gregory VII, just 9 months into his papacy, officially anyway, had declared his true intentions, something that even shocked the radical reformist Cluniacs, which were to usurp the Holy Roman Empire as belonging to the papacy and only the papacy. And herein lies where we find the reason for Peter Damian's accusation calling Hildebrand the Holy Satan. Satan, according to Christian theology and lore, was not the name of the fallen angel who first rose against God, not initially anyway. The name was Lucifer, meaning the bringer of light. When the defection and rebellion began, Lucifer became forever known as Satan, which in the original Hebrew simply means accuser or opponent, or even deceiver. What was Peter Damian really saying then? I think it was more than a battle of name-calling. I think he was declaring Hildebrand the opponent of the Catholic Church itself, the source of its current evils. That's not nothing. And with a gold-rimmed papal tiara, well, if Peter Damian were still alive in 1074, he had sadly died a couple years earlier, I'm sure he would have gone on his own little whirlwind writing tour spreading the name even more across Christendom. But at this point, we learn of what Spike calls, quote-unquote, a somewhat cranky note that Gregory had sent to the two Tuscan noblewomen, Beatrice and Matilda. Spike writes that the Pope, quote, berated them for entertaining the Bishop of Strasbourg as he traveled to Rome to do penance and reconcile with the Pope. Their generous hospitality to this pilgrim unfortunately violated the Pope's sanctions, which was, quote-unquote, a cause of shame to him because of their privileged positions in the Pope's circle, quote, that we who have forbidden this to other rulers should be charged with complicity on account of our intimate relations with you. End quote from Spike as well. Ouch. Either way, this letter spurred Beatrice to bring Matilda with her to Fiano, where they met and discussed matters with the Pope. Quote, Beatrice pledged 30,000 cavalry, of which 500 would be German, to protect the city. End quote. From Spike here. These three would spend a week together there in Fiano, just a half hour's drive north of Rome, far from the prying eyes of the Roman gossip machine. Now, on the surface, it was simply negotiations to aid the Pope in his campaign against Robert Guiscard, but just under the surface, which is where we should always look, there's much speculation as to what was actually occurring between Gregory VII and Matilda. The world may never know, but Beatrice was there, to use Spike's word, chaperoning it all. Who knows what really happened? Unless there's something hidden deep in the Vatican archives vault that one day makes the light of day, we will surely never know. So, speculate away, but it won't do any good. However, with word traveling quickly about Beatrice's pledge of Tuscan and German troops to the Pope's cause, we begin to see the rift in Matilda's marriage take full shape. It turns out that Godfrey III, still the Duke of Tuscany, though Beatrice and Matilda have been, for all intents and purposes, running the Tuscan duchy in his absence. Well, Godfrey III lent his full support behind King Henry IV of Germany, and they both began to foment rebellion to Tuscany's north, in the Lombard regions of northern Italy. So the ladies had to cut their visit short in Fiano and race back to their duchy to begin fortifying their castles and even fielding their own armies. Immediately, Gregory wrote a scathing letter to Godfrey III himself in Lorraine about him turning against his own wife, Matilda, and threatening the safety of her home. I mean, not to say she deserved death or anything, but she did kind of turn against him first. What real loyalty, except for the official church sanctioning of their marriage, what real loyalty did he really have for her? If Godfrey was mad at his wife, how could you blame him, to be quite honest? It was at this point that Gregory VII made another bold move. I'll let Spike explain. Quote, in the months after this meeting, the Pope's fondness for Godfrey's attractive wife spilled out into the open. His papal missives referred repeatedly to Matilda, naming her as the person he relied upon to intervene on his behalf with the king. In a letter to Sir Erlimbaldo, he praised Matilda for striving with her mother, quote, to bring harmony between the king and ourself, end quote. In another, to Henry's mother, the Empress Agnes, Gregory wrote, quote, your devoted Beatrice and Matilda, daughters to us both, are laboring day and night in our behalf, end quote. Why he chose to rely on the women from Canossa is open to question. And end quote of Spike's. What this resulted in would have far-reaching consequences for the church, but possibly, more importantly, for Matilda. Spike writes, quote, by his letters to the other rulers and bishops, the Pope enhanced Matilda's stature as a wise, competent, and capable ruler, end quote. Now, within a month or two after the synod, by late spring 1074, replies to his letters to Est, Burgundy, Toulouse, Savoy, and Tuscany had already rolled in, and it looked like Gregory would have the support he needed to take on the mighty Norman Duke. He announced the formation of his grand army to march south. The army, says Norwich, would assemble itself in June and then proceed to march toward Melfi. Oh, and says Norwich for good measure, Robert Guiscard was also officially excommunicated from the church. However, the author also adds, Gregory VII decided to give Guiscard one last chance to change his tune before before being engaged in actual combat against his combined papal forces. Quote, peremptory as always, he summoned Robert to meet him at Benevento for a final conference. Now it was the Guiscard's turn to feel alarm. End quote. Now, Robert no doubt had sudden flashbacks of Civitate just 20 years earlier. Both of these locations, Civitate and Benevento, were just outside of Norman territory. And though Civitate turned out fine for the Normans, I mean, you can't get much better than taking the Pope prisoner, can you? Things were different now. Norwich reminds us that 21 years earlier, there was a united Norman contingency led by Humphrey de Hauteville. Now, despite Robert's envoys loosening up their relations, the powerful Richard of Capua was still loyal to the Pope. In fact, Richard of Capua had lent his knights to the papal cause this time. That's right. There were Capuan knights within the papal forces against Guiscard. Robert Guiscard, to use Norwich's description of the reply, with unctuous humility, responded to Gregory VII's request for a meeting at Benevento, stating he never meant to disrespect the papacy and that he'd be happy to meet. But he knew what was really at play here, and he knew Gregory VII for who he was, who he'd really always been. Norwich writes, quote, in his long and rampageous career, Robert Guiscard had often been astonishingly lucky, but never had fortune smiled on him more kindly than at this moment. End quote. See, Robert Guiscard put together a stout defensive force of his own to accompany him to Benevento. He waited 3 full days outside of the walls of the city, no doubt a tactic employed by Gregory VII to establish who was really in control here. But by the 3rd day, according to Norwich, quote, dissension had broken out in its ranks. Once again, the fault lay with Gisulf of Salerno, end quote. Yeah, remember him? Gisulf II of Salerno, the pipsqueak little brother of Robert's wife, and the man who had been causing quite the ruckus with Guiscard since the old fox returned from conquering Palermo. Yeah, he had also joined the papal forces, and he was also at Benevento. But it wasn't just Guiscard that Gisulf was ticking off. No, Gisulf had used his navy previously to pester other maritime powers throughout the Tyrrhenian Sea, namely the Amalfitan and the mighty Pisans. So when Gisulf and his men joined Gregory VII's army that included Amalfitans and Pisans, well, words were shared and shoulders were shoved, and Gregory's grand army began to disintegrate into separate camps. All the while, Guiscard was outside the walls of Benevento, waiting for his audience with the Pope. The entire front that Gregory had carefully organized just fell apart, all because of a minor dispute between 2 minor factions of this great army. This was the smiling fortune that Norwich spoke of. Outside of the walls of Benevento, Robert Guiscard became aware of this little disintegration of the Pope's entire army, an army sent to kill him. The grim satisfaction must have been thick. Guiscard's smile, thicker still. For Gregory, this was an unmitigated disaster. Norwich adds, quote, the crusade which he had as good as promised the Byzantine emperor, and on which he had staked his reputation, was more remote than ever, end quote. His dreams, Norwich adds, of reuniting the Western Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church were shattered, really. I say again, this was an unmitigated disaster for Gregory VII. And what's more, his detractors began openly and actively looking to overthrow his papacy and rid them of the imperial pope once and for all. What an ending to Pope Gregory's first year. He came into the papacy at the top of his game, the near full support of the Roman aristocracy and the rest of Christendom, minus only Germany and those supported by the German crown, of course. But he ended it just humiliated, humbled, and stumbling back to a Rome that was turning against him quickly. So, what would be the Holy Satan's next move? Would he continue to be perceived as the holiest deceiver, as Peter Damian's nickname implies? Or would he finally take the route of the saint he would one day become? Until next time.